What's up, Stitches? It's time for your favorite historic needlework podcast, So What? I'm your gal, Isabella Rosner, and we're here on episode 19 of season 2. It's the penultimate episode of the season. Can you believe it? Season 2 has gotta go out with a bang, and today's interview absolutely fits the bill. This episode is an interview with Casey Zavalia, an artist who uses embroidery to create portraits that look like paintings. I have loved Casey's work for many years, so getting to interview her was, and still is, an absolute honor. Before we get to an overview of Casey and her work, and then the interview itself, I gotta say, for the penultimate time this season, that images of what we discussed today and links to Casey's social media, website, gallery, and other stuff are available on the So What social media pages and website. That's at So What Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and at sowhatpodcast.com. Okay, now back to the topic at hand. Casey Zavalia's works have been on display in museums and galleries in New York, California, Missouri, and Vermont. And her pieces are in collections in Kentucky, Maine, Pennsylvania, the Netherlands, and China. That reach, that global impact! Love to see it. I'm going to read her artist statement so you can get a better idea of the work she does before we get into the interview. It reads, quote, "I was originally trained as a painter, but switched to embroidery 18 years ago in an attempt to establish a non-toxic studio and create a body of work that referenced an embroidered piece I had made as a child growing up in Australia. My work focuses exclusively on the portraits of friends, family, and fellow artists. The gaze of the portrait toward the viewer has remained constant over the years and in my work, as has my search for a narrative based on both faces and facture. The work is all hand-sewn using cotton and silk thread or crewel embroidery wool. From a distance, they read as hyper-realistic paintings, and only after closer inspection does the work's true construction reveal itself. Over the years, I have developed a sewing technique that allows me to blend colors and establish tonalities that resemble the techniques used in classical oil painting. The direction in which the threads are sewn mimic the way brush marks are layered within a painting, which, in turn, allows for the illusion of depth, volume, and form. My stitching methodology borders on the obsessive, but ultimately allows me to visually evoke painterly renditions of flesh, hair, and cloth. A few years ago, I turned one of my embroideries over and for the first time saw the possibilities of a new image and path for my work that had been with me in the studio for so long but had gone unnoticed. It was the presence of another portrait that visibly was so different from the meticulously sewn front image, but perhaps more psychologically profound. The haphazard beauty found in this verso image created a haunting contrast to the front image and was a world of loose ends, knots, and chaos that could easily translate into the world of paint. This discovery led to a return to paint in my work and the production of a series of intimate gouache and large format acrylic paintings of these verso images. Highlighting the reverse side of my embroideries, which historically and traditionally has been hidden from the viewer, has initiated a conversation about the divergence between our presented and private selves. The production of both recto and verso images is now the primary focus of my studio work." End quote. So cool, right? Casey's pieces are brilliant, and I'm really, really excited for you all to learn more about her process, reflections on needleworking, and favorite examples of contemporary artists working with textiles. Here's the interview. Casey, thank you so much for being here today. How did you become an embroidery artist? And if you can you tell me a bit more about your artistic process?
I became an embroidery artist really out of necessity. I was trained as a painter in undergrad, then went on to get my had a 2-year break, and then went on to get my graduate degree at Washington University in St. Louis in painting. And then when I graduated, I painted for a little bit more, and then I was kind of bored of myself, like bored of what I was doing. And even though I love painting, I felt like I had kind of, it was like, who am I going to paint next? But I had exhausted what I felt like I personally was able to do with the medium. Also at the same time, I was pregnant with my first kid. And so out of necessity, I was having to kind of rid my studio of turpentine and varnish and fumes and that type of thing. So it was kind of like these two things happened at once where I was bored of myself and I needed to change. And I've always loved crafts. And so like as a kid, that was like my happy place, making things, gluing things, glitter, pom-poms, that whole world. And I think even when I was in undergrad and grad school, I was always trying to find a way to bring the craft world into the art world. So I tried like puff paint on my oil paintings, like all these kind of failed attempts of trying to bring these two worlds together. And so in the back of my mind, I had thought about doing an embroidered portrait. So I had this idea and I was actually teaching at Webster University at the time and had students do these self-portraits. And then I was like, take it out of the classroom, go home and do something to your portrait that isn't based on observation. One of my students took her portrait and projected it up onto like fly screen and then like really large and then sewed the whole thing with black wool. So it's like a positive negative portrait. And then when she brought it for the crit, she hung it kind of like from the ceiling with a bright light. So it was not only this embroidery, but it was like the shadow that was created on the floor. And I wish I could remember her name because like that was the thing that really gave me the confidence to try this embroidered portrait. I had done an embroidery as a kid when I was 13 of this Australian sheep station scene. And when I did those sheep out of French knots, it was like, it just blew my brain that I could make a sheep out of wool and then it looked like sheep's wool. So I had my mom send me that embroidery. I got some books on embroidery. And literally within the first 2 days, I realized this is absolutely not what I want to do. Like, I don't want to learn the students. I don't want to deep dive into the history of embroidery. I just want to use the medium in the same way that I would pick up a pencil and paper and draw without any, you know, any feeling that I had to know the rules of drawing or something like that. So that was my start to transform, to move from painter to embroidery artist. And then it was really like each piece informed the next. And it was like, I was teaching myself what I liked, what I didn't like. I know the very first one was quite small and I realized, oh, to do what I want to do, I have to scale up everything, scale up the size, scale up, no, I was already using crewel embroidery wool just to reference back to this piece I'd made as a kid, but like bigger needles, bigger, you know, better material to work on, those type of things. So the process, like I said, the each piece is informed the next. So the very first pieces were quite, I only had about 30 colors. So they were really more abstract. And I had to kind of jump the hurdle of, I used to be able to mix all my paint and now I have a limited palette of kind of like pre-mixed paint of these yarns, but how do I give this illusion of a shadowed area on a portrait or a highlight? And so it really became this system of building up the layers almost like in a pointillist approach, like a painter would, so that up close, it might look kind of abstract. From a distance, those things will blur together to create the color that doesn't exist in yarn. That's kind of like my process. And I love this medium because I was always stabbing at, like I said, trying to bring craft into my art, but I didn't realize the craft could be the art. And so like, and this moment in the art world is so perfect for that. But when I started this work, which was about 20 years ago, caring about your work and spending that much time on your work was not cool in the art world. Like that wasn't what was, it was more cool to make your work look like you didn't care about it and do it quickly and that type of thing. So I love that I arrived out of this out of necessity and getting pregnant and starting a family. And I really, like, I've always believed that having children informs one's work. And this is like a direct result of that belief. And so I really feel like it's doing what I want it to do in that it's like making the art world and the craft world hold hands. So when people enter my enter a gallery or museum to see my work from a distance, I want my embroideries to look like paintings. And then when you come closer, you discover that it's something other than that. And then I also do these like large verso paintings. So the like a back of one of my images, I find really interesting in an abstract way. And then I'll use that as my source imagery for these large paintings. So from a distance, they look like embroideries. And then when you get closer, they look like paintings. So it's this blur that I'm now interested in, because now I'm like, I just finished a 5-foot square embroidery that has more craft elements, large painted areas. So it's kind of really mixing up all of these things. They have pom-poms on them, sequins, beads, but I don't want any of those craft things to stand out from a distance. So when you enter in, you think it's an abstract painting, and then you get close and you hopefully have this like desire to touch it, and you can't.
I'm loving this. This is a real delight. Especially because I think about the hierarchy of the arts a lot, the mixture between art and craft a lot. And I think your work speaks beautifully to how those can be combined and how the hierarchy of arts and art versus craft should be a thing of the past.
Right. And
it does make a lot of sense to me. Like, of course, that you were a painter because your images, your embroideries are so painterly and so like brush strokes.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like too, like, you know, every artist is asked, like, what is art? And I don't think there's one answer to that. I think there's multiple answers to that. And for me, when people ask me that, I say it's for a time when there's no words. So when you want to say something and you can't, because you don't have the right words to say it, that's when you make art to say what you can't say with words. And I find the harder question for me is, what's the difference between craft and art? And
yes.
I don't know, because there could be a beautifully turned or carved wooden spoon that is really artistic, but it feels like it's still in the craft world. So, and I think that's why I'm not tired of this medium, is I think I'm still trying to figure that out. And it's a really great time in the art world where craft has been accepted like never before. It's almost like it's the new hippest thing, even mm-hmm. though it's been around for centuries. And because I don't know the answer of that, was when does craft shift over to art and when does some craft always stay as craft, that keeps me making in the studio to kind of like keep pondering that and thinking about it.
What are your favorite and least favorite parts of stitching?
So the thing that I love the most is that the material is approachable. So the fact that, you know, someone could go into a museum, maybe they never grew up in museums or were not taken to museums. They can walk into a gallery and be really intimidated by oil paint or gouache or egg tempera or marble sculpture because it seems very highbrow. And the thing mm-hmm. that I love about stitching is this material is so humble. It's cheap. It's mass produced. And even if you've never sewn, you've seen someone sew, or at the very least, you've held this material in your hand, you've slept under it, you've worn a sweater, you've wrapped your whole body in it and had it close to your heart. So when you then go into a gallery with this same material, there's a knowledge that you have of this material already that's very familiar to you. And then it just, the whole aspect, like you're not intimidated, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I love about this material. I feel like it also has this untapped potential. So it is so old. And yet if you look at the hashtag of embroidery, it is like a time warp back to 1970. And I don't understand that. I'm like, this material, just because you give paint to 100 people, mm-hmm. you will not get 100 paintings that look the same. They will all be completely different. So I think of it like the same thing. You give needlepoint and stitching materials to 100 people. You are going to have so many different results. And that's the part that I find is very exciting about this medium. My least favorite thing about it is that it's slow. And I feel like I'm not a very patient person. So that's like a love-hate thing, I hate it that it's slow, but I also love it because it puts me in that headspace that I need to be in to be creative. Yeah, those are two things.
That's a really good list. And out of curiosity, how long does it take you to embroider, like the one that you just finished, which was a 5-foot block, I think, or square? How long did that take?
That one took me 10 months only because it was when COVID struck.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, you know, everyone was panicking and you almost like could do nothing.
Oh, yes.
Walk around and be like, what's happening to our world? And that one was already on the go, which was great to not have to think like, oh, what could I do over COVID and quarantine? But like, okay, this is on the go and this is going to take me forever. But a typical embroidery that's like just under life size when I started out 20 years ago would take me 6 months for one. Plus I had small children, so I was making 2 to 4 per year. And now that size, just because I know what I'm doing in the medium and all that, it will take me 6 weeks to do that.
Oh my God, that's so impressive.
Which is still pretty fast, yeah.
That is so fast. Do you have any historical influences when it comes to your stitching? And if you don't, that is fine.
I am not, like I said, I still think of myself as a painter. Mm-hmm. And so I look at mostly painters, but I do things like, I thought I was going to do a whole series, but I was thinking a lot about red work and how I could. So I took like the backs of some images of my embroideries and just did that image as the work of art, but all in red, mainly because I just wanted it to be more portable, be able to watch TV and do something and mindlessly stitch. So I was really looking at a lot of red work, but then after I did 2 pieces, I didn't really take it further. Now I'm kind of sitting at this place like, okay, how can I mine this world that I'm thrown into? Because, you know, like I told you, I tend to resist the title of fiber artist, even though clearly I'm a fiber artist. I've been thinking a lot about cross stitch and I actually hate cross stitch. Like I, not that I hate to look at it. Teenager, I did like a Precious Moments cross stitch, which I wish I still had that. But it's just so dang like time consuming. Mm-hmm. And changing colors and all the counting, which is why it's called counted cross stitch. And so I've thought like, what about if I took something that I don't really like and tried to force myself to do something with it? So that's kind of like where I am, and hopefully we'll come up with something. I read this really great quote last night by the painter Laura Owens. I saved it because I kind of wanted to read it to you.
Please.
I feel like this is like totally captures how the fiber world and textiles has been overlooked. So anyway, she said, I was very inspired by a show of 50 years of textiles after the Bauhaus that I'd seen at the Art Institute while teaching there. All of the yardage in that show was shown stretched in 3-foot by 10-foot samples hung on the wall. When I walked into the show, I had the realization that they were paintings and that the history of textiles was an important part of the canon of painting and should not be omitted or segregated to a different department, but rather embraced. And I'm like, because when she was at the Art Institute of Chicago, she was looking at a lot of these textiles, and also her grandma did tons of cross stitch and that type of thing. And so she uses a lot of those imagery like in the layers of her paintings.
Love that.
And that's the best quote that I've heard of how this whole world has been overlooked, but there's so much to mine there, because I think it brings with it this kind of like world of nostalgia and comfort. And like I said, if your grandma sewed, it's just all wrapped up in that, but it's kind of like, how can I do something modern with that for, you know, the audience today?
What is your favorite needleworked object or objects? I'm happy with any time period, place, thing, group, whatever.
Okay, I have a couple because I just love the people that make the giantest leap from the craft world to the art world.
Oh, yes.
So one of the biggest ones was Doho Sa, which isn't like embroidery or needlework, but he does these scale models, like 1-to-1 scale models of his apartment in New York. made all entirely out of fabric, like silk fabric and thread.
That sounds amazing.
And then he's done his like childhood home. I think he's from Korea. So like his childhood home inside a temple hanging from the ceiling. And I first saw his work. I was in Sydney and I went to the Sydney Biennial. And so the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney had his New York apartment and you could walk through it. And I'm like, this is just made out of fabric and thread. So his work on so many levels just, I think, shows the potential of such humble materials. Then I'm also a big fan of Liza Liu, and her last name is spelled L-O-U. I don't know if you know her work.
No, on my way.
She beaded an entire kitchen, like every single thing in a kitchen. And then she also beaded an entire picnic area, the table, the chairs, the grass, the lawnmower, the ants, the whole thing. And she, that's her early work. And so now her work's like more minimal, but she did another one that was like barbed wire that was covered. It was like an enclosure for a penitentiary, like a small square. And then she also did one that was like in the, like a cross shape that like nobody could go in it, but you could imagine someone was walking in it in this cross shape. That had like a lot more kind of like a political statement of this barbed wire, and the whole thing was beaded. So super fan of hers. Tracy Emin.
Oh yeah.
The quilts that she's made. I love that she constantly jumps in and out of the craft world and the art world. And then the most recent ones of hers that I saw like at Art Basel were these almost like she'd done a figurative ink drawing and then blew it up really large and had, well, she's not doing them now, but I think she had a group of women who would come in and help her sew these. So from a distance, it looks like a giant ink drawing. And then you get close and you see it's all stitched. But what I loved about it and seemed totally her was there was just chunks of material just like randomly cut out to kind of fill in the really solid areas so someone wouldn't have to stitch and it would save time. I was like, wow, that's like totally genius. And I thought about that a lot in my recent big embroideries, like, okay, I could stitch it all, but I got to speed this up. So I started cutting up vintage needleworks, which you can find a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, I would either dye them to kind of subdue them a little bit, but I would cut out these shapes wherever they fit color-wise to, just speed up the process and kind of sew those down and then sew into them or onto them or something like that. And then, like I said before, I keep going back to, because it is a historical work, the piece that I made when I was 13, that's still hanging in my studio and I still look at that. And then probably the last artist that I love how she kind of straddles both worlds is Cornelia Parker.
Oh yeah.
And I love, I think she worked with like the Royal School of Needlework and also prisoners who were part of like the fine cell work group to stitch the Magna Carta. So they stitch the whole thing. And then she's also done a series of verso works where you see the back of the embroidery and the front of the embroidery all on the same side. So she works both sides of it. And then she also did this really interesting series where she had bullets melted down and drawn into really thin gauge wire, which she then made abstract drawings from. So she was stitching through the paper and speaking to a lot about, you know, things in our culture today with gun laws and gun violence and stuff, but they were these super minimalist stitch drawings made from bullets. So those are probably like my top.
That was an excellent selection. I am losing my mind over the beaded, the Lisa Liu stuff.
Liza Liu. Mm-hmm. One more too. An artist named Brent Wadden. Do you know his work? He does weaving. I'm just like lumping everything that's like craft together.
Oh,
I feel like that's
good.
Kind of
good.
The world.
Yes.
His name is Brent Wadden and he shows with like a big blue chip gallery, but he does these weavings that are giant, but they are abstract paintings. And so he just does a weaving, stretches it. And I've seen those at Art Basel too in Miami. And there's just something about, they're so modern, but at the same time, it's just a stretched weaving, you know, that just straddles both of those worlds in a really like eloquent way.
Mm, and I love his use of color.
Right. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That was a great selection. Thank you so much. What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
Well, I feel like it has multiple roles. I think it's always had multiple roles. So there's like the craft element of it, people who enjoy doing craft. There's also the functional role of where people are making things to keep warm or make sweaters or blankets or quilts or something like that. There's also the component of needlework as therapy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Cornelia Parker working with prisoners is just a really good example of like, you know, giving purpose to someone's life who's in prison and feeling like they're contributing to something. So I love the therapy role that it has. One thing I find interesting, I don't know if it's like a role, but I think it's a role that resurfaces in that when I started making this work, the internet and blogs wasn't really a big thing. Mm. And so I started it around the time of 9/11 when and I feel like the pandemic is putting us in a similar kind of state of mind. So when 9/11 happened, it was like the air got sucked out of the whole world. And all that mattered at the end of the day was love and family.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I didn't really say this earlier, but all the portraits that I do are of family. I made like a small departure to, I did a series of friends in Australia because I grew up in Australia. And so I captured everyone in my family from like teenager to now, but not really these friends who became our family when we lived in Australia when I was a kid. So I received a grant, went back there, took all their photos. And so did this whole show where just really thinking about how the definition of family has changed over the years, what is a family? Mm-hmm. But then also thinking about friends who become your family or take the place of family when it's Christmas and you're wondering, you're in another country and like, who's going to have us over for Christmas? Or maybe you're in that position, you know, in London.
Yeah.
But when the blog started going and you started seeing more people using stitching in their work,
mm-hmm.
One thing was interesting is that we all started around the same time. So this time around 9/11, and I read this article, which I wish I had saved, but it spoke about how when things like that happen in the world, there's this return to craft.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like this comforting thing, like all of a sudden people want to knit and people want to crochet and people want to, and so whatever there is about that, make bread. And, you know, those type of things have a resurgence as they are right now in the pandemic. So I think there's this something about it having this role of comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if wrapped up in that is nostalgia for when you were a kid. That is definitely a role that it fills. And I think when our world has those kind of times of resurgence, it's this time to show it to this younger generation, or like moms my age are getting their kids involved and like, oh, you should try this, or, you know, something to pass the time or something to get them off the screens or something mm-hmm. like that. And I think one thing that's like really beautiful is that we all have the same story. It's either my grandma taught me how to sew. My aunt was always stitching around. There's some kind of story that we all have the same story. But, you know, one thing I love that I was thinking about this morning is, you know, my love of craft was really born from my grandma's love of craft and making Christmas ornaments. And I didn't even grow up with my grandma. So for her to influence me so much in that way, that here's a woman who grew up in Detroit, Michigan, who did not go to college, who primarily worked at mental state hospitals. And so she would make Christmas ornaments with the patients, but then also with her fellow workers, like when they were on breaks and like, oh, I've just got this new Christmas ornament, like, and they would exchange ideas. And then she would come to Australia with all the supplies ready in her bag for us to get going on these craft objects. And so I love that, like, this was the beginning that led to my current work that's in hanging in galleries and museums. Like, to have that connection of, you know, because I don't think she even really grew up going to art museums or, you know, didn't mm-hmm. have much knowledge at all of the art world. And to see the string that's connected from her to what I'm doing today is really sweet.
Last question. How can people learn more about your work? And is there anything you'd like to promote?
Well, right now I have nothing to promote. I think
because we're in a pandemic, fair enough.
but that's like kind of a blessing in disguise. I think all artists, we get on this train of like, if you exhibit in art fairs, which I love art fairs, but you're on this train of like, okay, Miami's going to be in December. So I need to start a work so it's done by November and I can get it to my dealer. So you're on this like invisible calendar of the art fairs, not on your own studio rhythm. Mm. And so when all that ended, and my gallery in New York closed over COVID, but I still have my gallery here in St. Louis. It was kind of like there was no deadlines for anything. So I was grateful for that just because I had ideas of things to experiment with. And that always gets pushed aside when you're on this like deadline schedule. So I have a giant embroidery hanging at my gallery here in St. Louis, which is actually open if people are in St. Louis and want to go see it. And then I'm actually going to have a piece at the St. Louis Art Museum in October, which I forgot about, and which is a real exciting thing to be recognized in your own hometown by such a major institution. They're putting together a kind of like a historical show of this region, artists who were in this region making from history up until now. And it kind of covers all mediums. So painting, quilting, historical artifacts, like lots of areas are going to be displayed in the show. And then I'm going to spend kind of the summer just enjoying my family and experimenting. So I think Freeze opened in New York this week, and that's the first art fair in the US that is open. So it'll be the real tester of if these other fairs can be in person. And if they are, I'll probably show in Chicago in September at Expo Chicago, if that opens. Mm. So it's like I have distant deadlines, but nothing urgent right now. And then people can find me. I'm on, I have my own website, caseyzavalia.com. And then also I'm pretty active on Instagram, not only to show my own work, but I love it as a platform to kind of cheer on other artists that I follow who maybe don't have a ton of followers and I want to show their work, or, you know, artists in the art world that I love and look up to. So
amazing. Yeah. Casey, this has been such a treat and an honor, and I've learned so much. So thank you incredibly much for the interview today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Great interview, right? What a treat. I really value Casey's thoughts on the overlap and intersection of art versus craft, and I am absolutely obsessed with all the contemporary textile artists she discussed. Please do check their stuff out because it's really amazing and so varied. And after all, variety is the spice of life. I don't really have a lovely, insightful thought to conclude with this episode because I really think Casey's works speak for themselves, and I think that she and her embroidery do a really good job of illustrating the power of stitch to reflect other media, in this case painting. I've said it before and I'll say it again, a needle is like a paintbrush and a thread paint. A stitch can be and is just as evocative and emotive and powerful as a brush stroke. And that is such a beautiful thing. Now, that's all I've got for this episode. See you next week for the last episode of season 2. Can you believe it? I cannot. Thank you to Casey for the interview, and thank you all for listening. And for all of you at home, be sure to like, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Now go out and stitch some stories and help broaden the possibilities of what can be done with embroidery. Bye!